Thanks. Jen and I are going to tag team it, so I'll take the first part and hand it off to her, and then we'll kind of make it up as we go along after that. Along with the two of us, there's also Dan Dennis and Von Koo, who's also Jefferson, and who we kind of all contributed in putting this together. We are also from Philadelphia, so Philadelphia must be a hotbed of innovative homelessness research. And I actually will go and say this is innovative. I've not seen research like this before on homeless populations, and I'll go into that, even though I don't know if I'd call it breaking the mold, but it kind of comes at learning about homelessness population characteristics from a different perspective. Before I get started with that, a lot of agencies and people affiliated with these agencies contributed data, input, and otherwise were helpful to this project, and so we're acknowledging them. And we didn't put a slide about, like, the conflict of interest and anything, and like everybody else has seen, we don't have any. Basically, a little bit of background here. And this kind of debate goes back as long as there's been interest in contemporary homelessness, which means it goes all the way back to like the late 70s, early 80s, and that pertains to the size of the homeless population, and also the characteristics of the homeless population. And homeless are a notoriously difficult population to sample and to count. Most of the homeless population, to the extent to which they use services, and most homeless, as far as we can tell, do use services, are relatively easy, especially if they use shelters. Then, you know, they're a captive population, or at least in the evening they are. But there's enough homeless who don't use shelters, who sleep outside, or they sleep in other kind of living arrangements. Maybe they'll occasionally use shelters. Maybe they will go to soup kitchens or other homeless services. So in addition to people regularly use shelters, you have people who sporadically use shelters. And you also have people who don't use shelters at all. And so typically that affects like sampling frames, questions of whether you get representative populations, and also questions about population size. So that back in, which is now ancient history, and the scary thing is I remember all this kind of, you know, firsthand, when there were questions like back in the days of Mitch Snyder, he said there were 2 to 3 million homeless. HUD said no, there were 200,000 to 300,000 homeless in actuality, and there was this big debate about how big the actual homelessness population was. One of the big questions was that of the hidden homeless, and it's like then researchers who typically the more rigorous the study, the lower the numbers got, where the advocates were, you know, basically accusing them of saying, well, you're not looking hard enough for this hidden homeless population. And then the researchers would come back and say, well, show me where they are. And then they would say, well, they're hidden. You can't find them. And there was this kind of this round and round. And that also got to be an issue with later on when there were kind of systematic efforts to get a representative sample of the homeless population and sampling frames. And you had people like Peter Rossi and Martha Bird who came up with innovative ways to sample and get generalizable information about what the characteristics were of the homelessness population. But there was still always this question, how representative is that? And so I don't, you know, we're not looking to dredge up those old debates, but we're looking to kind of put a different perspective on this. And what we're doing here is we're looking at kind of, you know, the one point where the hidden homeless kind of come out of hiding, and that pretty much is at the point at which they die. And Philadelphia is relatively unique in that through the medical examiner's office we have what's called a homeless death review, and what that is just about everybody who doesn't die in a hospital setting goes through the medical examiner's office. The medical examiner does an investigation, kind of looks into the circumstances of death, cause of death, and otherwise does an assessment. And when during the course of that and a decedent has been identified as being homeless, then they get referred to the death review. There's also various Philadelphia hospitals that participate in this process, and when they identify somebody who's been hospitalized as being homeless, they'll also pass that information over to this death review committee. And the homeless death review committee is comprised mostly of people from representing different agencies in Philadelphia who in one way or another work directly with the homeless population. So you obviously have homeless providers. That includes the municipal shelter system, the Philadelphia Office of Supportive Housing are called, but they also run the shelter systems. You have nonprofit shelters who are not part of that system. You have the homeless outreach, but you also have the city behavioral health services. You have the local hospitals. You have criminal justice. You have representatives from jail and from the police department. The VA comes out. The city AIDS office comes out, and you know, pretty much the list that I had on that second slide. You had representatives from there. We all sit around a table, and basically each person gets staffed. There's typically we meet every 2 or 3 months, typically about maybe 20 people who are on a list, and that all gets staffed where everybody who has interacted with this person kind of participates and says, well, you know, this person stayed at a shelter so many times, or this person was hospitalized at a hospital X number of times. And what you do is you kind of get this composite profile of people, and some people were very well known to the system, and there was people in the room who knew them personally, and there was other people who were seemingly all the way off the radar, and there was a gamut, and there was, you know, just kind of a whole continuum between those two endpoints. And so what this study did was we kind of compiled all of this data, and we used that as a starting point to see what's the next slide? Okay, I'll just say the questions, and then I'll hand it over to Jana for the methods. And basically, two questions is, you know, we're looking at the relationship of these decedents who've been identified as homeless. How, to what extent do they use homeless services? And then, based on their use of homeless services, you know, how are the populations different or similar? So first of all, is when we survey people or when we count people based on kind of services-based interviewing, how big a proportion of the homeless population are we actually capturing, and then how similar are those to the people that we're missing? And this is still relevant. I mean, God knows, we still survey homeless people, and also we regularly count them. At least once every 2 years, each jurisdiction in the U.S. is required to do what's called a point-in-time count, PIT count, where they go out and count everybody on a given night who's in a shelter, and then they also have a street count where volunteers, and I generally participate in it myself, where we go out into selected areas of the city and actually look for homeless people late at night who would otherwise be left out of the shelter count, and we count them, and if they are awake, coherent, and cooperative, we'll actually ask them a couple of questions. So again, this research still very much kind of informs how accurate is this count and how representative are the people that we're getting. And so that's kind of the conceptual. Jen has done a lot of the data analysis and kind of the nuts and bolts of it, so I'll hand it over to you.
Hi. So basically, we had 141 homeless decedents over this 3-year period. We originally had 143, but two of them were babies, so we chose to not include them in that analysis. And Steve already talked how we got, you know, records came from various sources. And so essentially we grouped these decedents into 3 groups based on their homeless service use. So they either, you know, they didn't use any services, those are our non-service users, minimal service users, and then known service users. And so we basically compared them, you know, their characteristics and their geography. So this was the breakdown. You know, non-service users made up 24%. Most were known to the system. So if you're not familiar with Philadelphia, you can see this kind of cluster where the red is. So that's like Center City. You can think of City Hall as a landmark. That's pretty much where a lot of the homeless services are centered. And so that's where most of our decedents were found. And then as you go farther out into the lighter green, that's kind of like northeast sections of Philadelphia, which is technically considered part of the city, but is certainly not walking distance to, you know, these services, unless you're very ambitious. Do you want to add something?
So a little geography lesson here. So like Janice said, this is Center City. This is where most of the homeless this is a map kind of showing the distribution of where the homeless deceased were found. And so the concentration is unsurprisingly here in Center City and in kind of areas around it. And that's where most of the street count is focused in this area here. And what you see is, like Janice said, the numbers get less as you go into the more outlying areas. This is where typically the density of the housing gets a bit spread out, and homeless are a lot less visible than they are in the downtown location. And what you see is that there are still people that pop up in kind of the more outlying areas, not as much of a quantity, but this is kind of where the non-service using and the more sporadic users, where they are found. So, you know, not only do we miss them in terms of the services used, but these are also people who are missed geographically.
So the majority of the decedents were male. Most of the non-service users were white, as compared to the known service users.
That's a finding too. That's kind of noteworthy. I just wanted to emphasize this because typically homeless populations are seen as disproportionately African American. Even in cities like Philadelphia, which have a high African American population, the percentage that are African American is even higher than that. And that's pretty much, and conversely, the proportion of whites in homeless population is typically very low. And that's what we find here among the service-using population. Surprisingly, that flips when you look at the non-services-using population.
Yeah.
There it becomes 68% white, and that kind of, the implications for that is that homelessness among whites is higher than people are aware of, but they also avoid avoid shelters and traditional homeless services, possibly because it's seen as being primarily for African Americans. Again, it's a big difference between the service using and non-service using.
Yeah, and you can see the 20%. The majority in the known service users were African American. Oops. So this slide looks at age at death, and you can see that the non-service users were most younger, as compared to both the known and the minimal service users. And this was another significant finding. So death by injury, among the non-service users, this hidden population that we keep calling them, a lot more of them died by injury versus natural causes. So that's another thing, you know, that we noted.
That also corresponds with the age. So, you know, if you die of accidental causes, you're probably going to die younger.
Absolutely. So a few significant findings. So the non-service users were actually, you know, a lot more likely to have a diagnosed alcohol abuse or dependency problem. And, you know, conversely, known service users were more likely to have a diagnosed severe mental illness, maybe because they were, you know, known to the service systems and were using services. You have a question?
How did you know that?
This is all diagnosed, I'm glad you brought that up. One thing to remember, we looked at services users, that's homeless services users. So a lot of the homeless services users still used healthcare services, were still in the criminal justice system and other services systems. So this is all based on either diagnosis or treatment. So they were known to one system or another as and were diagnosed as having an alcohol use disorder, or down here as having a severe mental illness.
So third here is homeless.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
So the
non-drug
users or using criminal or in other systems.
Correct.
Yes, and it's important to make that distinction. Yeah.
Like medical.
Yeah, so you can see here that non-service users, you know, a lot of them did have an arrest record, incarceration record. The bolded are statistically significant, so ICM is intensive care management.
Case management.
Intensive case management, sorry.
So looking at this a little more, too, what you see, typically, you know, the services users, their rate of, like, Medicaid use, their SSI and SSDIs, of course, disability, we had the presentation last time. The rates of health services use disability is a lot higher among the known services users. And so that, and also combined with age, kind of suggests that, you know, this is a much more, the more disabled the population, the more they're going to be, they're going to gravitate towards homeless services. And also the more that's going to color the way we perceive the homeless population in general, where you still obviously have high rates on the non-services users, but the rates are considerably lower. Surprisingly, you know, again, high rates of criminal justice use here, but the differences aren't that high. These were found not to be statistically significant, these differences, after adjusting for other things. But you'd expect, by virtue of being a younger population, by virtue of being, you know, just kind of outside of the homeless system, I would have expected these rates to be higher comparably than these. And then this middle group that we haven't talked about much, they kind of swing back and forth into whether they're more similar to the non-services users or the services users. And here, really, they're pretty much in the middle in terms of their use of other services systems. So you get kind of a very mixed, you get, you know, distinct differences for the most part between populations, not only services use, but also with respect to demographics and with respect to behavioral services.
So,
go ahead.
In conclusion, we paint this picture of this hidden subgroup of the homeless population that are not included in, you know, conventional counts because they're not visible. So, you know, they have different characteristics, and perhaps we need a different effort to better capture this population.
Yeah, so, you know, based on our findings, if you rely on homeless populations who only use services, then you are only getting a segment of the population. It's, you know, up to a quarter of the people you're not going to see in the services system at all. And then you're going to have another group that, you know, on something, if you include a street survey or if you include, like, outreach or soup kitchens, you'll probably get a good bit of them. But, you know, at least a quarter of them, from our findings, you're likely to miss. And, you know, you need to take that into account. There's biases to that. There's also biases to the way that we did it. This is just, like I said, this is a different perspective. This gets us looking at the more traditional counts in a different way. And so we'll basically close with that. This is the first time we've presented these results.
Yes.
So we're writing them up and love to hear reactions about it. Yeah.
So do you think better communication, collaboration, continuity of care between the different types of services, like the non-homeless versus the homeless services, would help capture them better, or do you think those other services aren't even capturing that they're homeless?
I think I would say yes, in that you're going to get some of both. This group is, you know, the group that gets missed, I would say, is a much harder group to engage, in the sense that geographically they're all over the city. They are not typically in where, like, outreach teams go.
Anecdotally, these are people who live in, who are known to live in vacant buildings or in like sheds in somebody's backyard or something like that. Sometimes they were known locally. Other times they had just gotten out of prison, so they were, you know, so they weren't in the system because they, you know, they just didn't have that much of a chance to get in the system. So it's a very mixed bag. I think what comes out most starkly with the racial divisions is that this, that among this group are also people who consciously avoid that. So when, you know, if they were identified and there were outreach efforts being made, these would be among those who are most resistant to coming in. And so, you know, engaging them for things like housing, probably, you know, probably the best place to touch them would be, or the best place to reach out to them would be the places that they do touch the system, but then you'd have to, you know, you'd have to find a way to figure out that they were actually homeless. And, you know, for those of us who work with the homeless, a lot of times, this is a group that seeks to blend in, and, you know, they don't necessarily advertise their homelessness. So it's, we can show you this, but don't necessarily have any answers for you.
Yeah.
These are people who, at the time they died, were, you know, they were found in Fairmount Park, which is a large urban park. They were found in vacant buildings or in other homeless settings. There are also interviews done with, through the medical examiner's office. They have investigators that'll talk, that'll identify and talk with next of kin or neighbors or people like that. And sometimes the determination there is that they were homeless. There was a local story about one guy who had a heart attack on the bus and like rode on the bus like all night before somebody actually found him. And again, in kind of investigating more in the situation, it was determined that he was homeless. And this was something that was also very delicate because it was not something that the family was very forthright about disclosing. And so it gets, so it's kind of a unique situation in that, you know, the resources are there a lot of times. For homeless. By the other token, again, and this kind of goes back to the debate I talked about, I'm sure this is not a complete set of everybody who's homeless who dies in Philadelphia. So there are people who are missed. So there's kind of the hidden among the hidden homeless, and, you know, the debate kind of would continue there. So.
Just to be clear about that, does that mean that the couch surfers are
no, this is a tradition. This is a kind of a literal definition of homelessness that's consistent with HUD's definition. So if somebody was living doubled up, chances are they'd not have been included.
Would there be a way to also do this for those people?
Yeah, there would be. It would be, you know, it would be more resource. It would get more complicated, but conceivably that would be possible, yes. Yes.
So non-service users were a lot younger than both minimal and known service users. Yeah, that was one of our kind of significant findings.
So part of that is, part of that
18 to 40 and then 40 and above.
Mm. Yeah, and also, you know, that's kind of, you know, if you work with, you know, typically people will avail themselves more of services as they get older. It just gets harder to live on the streets the older you get. Not that it's ever easy. Anything else, sir?
Yeah. Do you have access to that medical examiner sort of determination process, like information that's gleaned from that? Because I mean, that may get to some of the causes and backgrounds of people, even especially if they're completely out of the system. I mean, do you have? Can you talk about that?
That data is available, so I mean there are case files in the medical examiner's office where, you know, the investigators will write up what they find, the data they'll compile, interviews with next of kin and other people. That data is not available for this study, and so we basically have the nature of the data we have is a lot more quantitative, just, you know,
engagement with different services, levels of services use, and different things like that. But conceivably, that can be done. Also, what has been done, which is really interesting and hasn't made the light of day outside of the medical examiner's office yet, is that timelines have been devised. So going back like as far as like 10 or 15 years, where like all the services have been tracked, and this includes times that they've been in housing, times that they've been hospitalized, times that they've been engaged with other providers, and you can really kind of see a biography come together based on how the services were used. And ultimately, you know, the goal of the medical examiner's office, is the Homeless Death Review Committee, isn't so much to gain understanding for like research sake as much as it is to see possible intervention points where these deaths can be where some of these deaths can be prevented, either in individual cases or just more generally. And that's, and so that's kind of where everything kind of focuses on. Yes.
So it seems like you guys were putting together, like, you guys pulled together data from all these different sources, which is amazing. And that's something you've been struggling with in San Antonio. And, like, you've got all these data systems, but, you know, can my organization access all of them? No, I can only access some of them. Can you guys talk about how you got that together and how the data here is moving?
I don't take credit for getting the Death Review Committee together. That was done by the medical examiner's office. I mean, again, just... death just provides a window in that confidentiality is still there, but it gets relaxed. I mean, there are still, you know, HIPAA restrictions become a bit more ambiguous, as far as I know. But the cooperation of like healthcare providers to share that data, including data from the city's AIDS organizing.
AIDS Activities Coordinating Office.
Thank you. Where, you know, they're willing to provide what is usually very sensitive data that where these people alive never would have gotten shared. So that's part of it. And then I think once it gets together, you know, once this data does get compiled, then there's more receptiveness to actually doing something with that. So, you know, make no mistake, the confidentiality restrictions and are still quite substantial. The data that we have here were all, and that's kind of nice too. So the data we worked with were all de-identified before we got it, which makes our lives a lot easier. And so that data, the more qualitative data, is compiled in the medical examiner's office. And so it's, I guess to answer your question, it's a series of steps for, you know, you kind of start out, let's get together, let's staff these deaths, and then just more things become possible.
Okay. Well, thanks, Steve.
Sure.
Thank you.